Hi, it's Indie Week, the weekly edition journal read for you today by John Feddersen on the North Carolina Reading Service for our blind and print impaired listeners. And our issue dated April the 28th, 2021. And for our music today, we continue our experimental outreach to music communities that are maybe not mainstream. And this is interesting because sort of in tribute to the 17-year cicadas outbreak all around the nation, we've engaged actually 20, 30 of them to provide our musical theme song today. Give a listen and see how well they imitate a violin and even a piano. Well, just from rubbing their hind legs on their carapace, they achieve those remarkable sounds. So that's our cicada choir. And let's get on with our regular issue. A letter from the editor begins this issue. Jane Porter writes, inexcusable. His hands were on the steering wheel. He was shot in the back as he tried to drive away. Less than 24 hours after Derek Chauvin, the Minnesota cop convicted of killing George Floyd, was led away in handcuffs last week, reports rolled in that two more black people in America were shot to death by law enforcement officers. Makia Bryant, a 16-year-old child from Columbus, Ohio, was the first. She was killed near her home just minutes before the Chauvin verdict came down. The second was Andrew Brown, Jr., a 42-year-old man from Elizabeth City, located some 2 hours northeast of Raleigh near the Outer Banks. Excuses were made about Bryant's killing almost immediately, just as they are about the vast number of people killed by law enforcement officers in this country, roughly 2 people per day, according to data from the American Civil Liberties Union. Bryant was holding a knife when she charged at another girl who was pinned against a car, police said. And right now, from Fox News to the Federalist, excuses are being deployed to try to explain away Brown's killing. He was a felon. He was being served drug-related search and arrest warrants. He was trying to flee. Neither Bryant's nor Brown's killing is excusable. Nor is 13-year-old Adam Toledo's in Chicago, nor 20-year-old Duante Wright's in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, nor, as we finally saw, officially, following a grueling, exhausting year filled with pain, was George Floyd's in Minneapolis. The circumstances around Brown's death are chilling. Initial reports from Brown's family members and neighbors who saw what happened last Wednesday morning describe sheriff's deputies on the scene to serve Brown with arrest and search warrants. Brown was in his car. As he tried to drive away, the deputies opened fire, shattering the vehicle's back window. Brown crashed into a neighbor's tree. When the deputies reached the vehicle and opened the door, Brown was dead. He was shot in the back. On Friday, 7 Pasquotank County Sheriff's Office deputies were placed on leave. On Monday, attorneys for Brown's family and some family members were allowed to watch 20 seconds of body camera footage to try to bring them some clarity as to what happened while the State Bureau of Investigation looks into the killing. It wasn't much, but for Brown family attorney Chantel Cherry Lassiter, it told her all she needed to know. Sheriff's deputies blocked Brown in his driveway and approached his vehicle, shooting AR-223 semi-automatic rifles and Glock 17 pistols. They opened fire instantly in a residential neighborhood at 8:30 on a weekday morning. A neighbor who, mercifully, wasn't home at the time told the News and Observer that a bullet went through his home and broke the glass of a clock. Cherry Lassiter said in a press conference Monday afternoon, "Let's be clear, this was an execution. He had his hands firmly on the steering wheel. They ran up to his vehicle shooting. He still stood there, sat there in his vehicles with his hands on the steering wheel while being shot at. His hands were on the steering wheel." Many terrible details are likely to emerge soon about Brown's killing, a process that has been slow to unfold so far. will know more once a judge authorizes the release of more body cam footage expected soon. The result of an autopsy Brown's family is commissioning also are pending. And we'll certainly hear more about Brown's alleged drug dealing, his criminal history, 20-year-old convictions for trespassing and assault, anything and everything that can be dredged up to paint Brown, a father of 10 and longtime resident of Elizabeth City, as a criminal lowlife. We must let none of it obscure the fact that Brown did not deserve to die that way. The truth, contained in the facts, as relayed by witnesses, neighbors, and a lawyer, remains. His hands were on the steering wheel. He was shot in the back as he tried to drive away. On to news. Thomas E. McDonald's column from Durham, Self-Preservation. Valeta Holmes has lived in Walltown, one of Durham's historically black neighborhoods, since the 1960s. On Saturday, she described how aggressive, affluent newcomers appear at the front doors of working-class homeowners, quote, with envelopes full of cash, offering to buy your house. She said during a late morning press conference, people tell them, get the hell off my property. She was on the grounds of the Walltown Park Recreation Center, which her mother, a retired math teacher, helped to start. The Walltown Community Association, WCA, helped organize the press conference as it grapples with a decade of gentrification in the neighborhood located north of Duke University's East Campus. At the gathering, community leaders discussed their two-year-long fight following the 2018 purchase of the 45-acre Northgate Mall by Northwood Raven, a real estate firm specializing in luxury apartment developments, and particularly the firm's redevelopment plans for the old mall. Holmes, a network administrator with Durham County, told a crowd of about 50 people, I feel like they're trying to close us out, and I don't want to leave my neighborhood. Under Northwood Raven's proposal, the mall redevelopment would take place in two phases. The first would include construction of 6 four-story buildings with the ground floors used for retail and housing on the remaining 3 floors. The mixed-use buildings would surround a large green space with some access available to Walltown residents at Guess Road and West Club Boulevard. Meanwhile, the second phase of the redevelopment proposes building 2 10-story buildings close to Interstate 85 and Gregson Street. The first phase of this proposal does not need to go before the Durham City Council or the Durham City County Planning Commission, as it's a residential plan with some commercial development. Nate Baker, an urban planner who serves on the Planning Commission, said that Walltown's struggle is, quote, indicative of a broken planning system, he said in a text message to the Indy. This will show the community what inequitable development looks like. I do not think it squares at all with shared equity goals. We're pretty much letting Northwood Raven get away with what they want unless the Walltown organizers can win concessions, which is a big burden on them. Durham Mayor Steve Shule says he supports the WCA efforts, but his influence is limited. He told Indy, I've met with a developer to urge them to provide the affordable housing and green space the community is advocating for. I'll continue to support WCA. In an email to city officials, Jeff Furman, an operations director for Northwood Raven, said responsibility to work with residents to find solutions to relieve gentrification lies with city leaders. He wrote, asking private landowners to solve the city's issues is a misdirected mission. While we appreciate the ideas coming from Walltown, we instead encourage the neighborhoods to work directly with the city and its elected officials to change public policy to relieve gentrification and locate more affordable housing and affordable retail on nearby underutilized public land. In December, Walltown resident Brandon Williams and his neighbor went before the Durham City Council to share 3 maps developed over 2 years for a new Northgate that would allay concerns that redevelopment of the property without community input would continue to displace and undermine black wealth by elevating the already increasing property taxes and rents in our community, Williams told the council. He called the maps, quote, a vision based on the hopes, desires, and experiences of Walltown residents, centering the people who have been and will continue to be most impacted by gentrification in the area surrounding Northgate. WCA leaders say the developers should provide long-time and low-income Walltown residents with an ownership stake in the mall's redevelopment, including stock shares and seats on the board to preserve and build wealth in the community. The Neighborhood Association also wants Northwood Raven to set aside 30% of the development for affordable units, provide first right of purchase and rental to low-income Walltown residents, create and foster community gathering places, and develop a section of the site as a transportation hub for buses and bicyclists. During the Saturday press conference, WCA leaders and neighborhood supporters discussed those three alternatives, focused on housing, green spaces, and accessible transportation hub to the Northwood Raven redevelopment proposal. Marcia McNally with the Durham Coalition for Affordable Housing and Transit helped develop the alternative maps. McNally said Walltown residents questioned how they would access Northwood Raven's proposed green space areas. She told the Indy, it's a green space, yeah, but it all looks so private. It's surrounded by four-story buildings with rents starting at $1,200 to $1,300 a month. It just looked so exclusive and sat so far back from the road. With the redevelopment looming, some long-time Walltown residents, particularly younger ones, are embittered by the changes brought by gentrification. Alvin Black, a 32-year-old entrepreneur who spoke at Saturday's press conference, said he first moved to Walltown as a child in the late 1990s because it was affordable for his family. He grew up surrounded by aspirational figures and sturdy role models. Now, he sees families forced out because they can't pay property taxes. Black showed the Indy a video of himself standing in front of the modest home of George Wall, a formerly enslaved man and Duke janitor who founded Walltown in the early 1900s. Today, Wall's home at 1015 Onslow Street is worth more than $260,000, according to the real estate website Zillow. Just across the street, another house was knocked down to build a 7,000-square-foot home that sold for more than $1 million in August. Black said, so many families have been displaced. There should be a redevelopment of a place unredlined for black people. This is dispossession, massively personified. Holmes shared a painful story about a man who, like Wall, worked as a janitor at Duke. The man lived in Walltown for 30 years and paid around $300 a month in rent. His landlord asked him to move out while he renovated the place. When the renovations were completed, the landlord raised the rent and the gentleman had to move out. Holmes said in the process of moving, he had a heart attack and died. In 1902, George Wall purchased a plot of land in a stretch of woods for $50. And according to a story in the 2015 spring issue of Duke Magazine, quote, soon after he built a small wood frame cottage, one story tall, one room wide, and a few rooms deep with a brick chimney and a little shed-roofed stoop in front. Soon other black families settled nearby, forming a close working-class community. In the 1920s, around the time Trinity was renamed Duke University, the industrious little hamlet two blocks north was coined Walltown. Wall died in 1930. Today, no black residents live in that section of Onslow Street, Williams said at the press conference. It was a self-contained community that speaks to the dynamics of segregation. It was a self-sufficient neighborhood That legacy continues to shape the neighborhood. In 2019, the WCA conducted door-to-door studies of Walltown residents to ask what they would want to see with the mall property. Affordable housing and retail topped the survey lists. The nonprofit DataWorks assisted the WCA in looking at property value changes between 2017 and 2019. County tax records indicated the greatest concentration of property value changes in the neighborhoods near the mall took place in Walltown. Residential property values there increased as much as 900%, according to the report. DataWorks concluded, quote, "This makes residents vulnerable to displacement because 53% of Walltown workers are in sectors that have had flat or decreasing wages over the last 20 years. Williams said that the area median income in Walltown is around $37,000. Community members won't be able to afford rents or housing costs in the proposed development. Williams said, that's not going to do much for us over here. It will not touch folks in our neighborhood. When we say affordable housing, we want it at that $37,000 level and below." Williams said the WCA would like to see 110 units set aside for affordable housing. "In order to have a sense of community," he said, "people have to live here." Our next article first appeared in North Carolina Health News, an independent, nonpartisan, non-for-profit statewide news organization. Visit them at NorthCarolinaHealthNews.org. Title, "The Tipping Point" by Rose Hoban. In the 18 weeks since the first North Carolinian received a vaccination against the novel coronavirus that's upended the world for the past year, the state has managed to put about 6.6 million doses of vaccine into the arms of more than 3.8 million people. That mass vaccination effort led to 650,000 doses being administered the week of April the 5th. That week, though, is likely to be a high water mark. In the week starting April 12th, 520,000 doses of vaccine were administered, a lower number than the average for the six previous weeks. And with just under half the adult population in North Carolina having a vaccination now, local and state officials are anticipating that increasing the numbers of vaccinated will be more of a slog. A new report from the Kaiser Family Foundation estimates that the United States will likely, quote, "reach a tipping point on vaccine enthusiasm in the next 2 to 4 weeks." The report writers surmise that once this occurs, efforts to encourage vaccination will become much harder, presenting a challenge to reaching the levels of herd immunity that are expected to be needed. Census data compiled last week by Carolina Demography found 2.5 million North Carolina adults reported they are vaccine hesitant, quote, meaning they will either probably not or definitely not get a vaccine, or they did not plan on receiving all required doses. In places such as Craven County, Health Director Scott Harrelson said he's seen a distinct softening of demand for vaccines. At first, he said, when his department would announce 800 vaccination appointments on their schedule on their website, most of them would be filled within half an hour. Recently, though, he's started to see the process slow. He said, appointments were hanging out there for, 24 hours plus, and then we said, okay, I think we're at a point now where we're just going to say 18 and up. Earlier this month, he reported his department is scaling back. He said, we're going to taper down and go to 3 days a week, then two, then we're going to cycle out and just have some probably Moderna on hand here in the health department for people who call in. With greater availability at physicians' offices and drug stores, the county-run clinics aren't as vital a link to a vaccine. Cody Kinsley, Deputy Secretary of Health at the State Department of HHS, we are definitely getting to a place where, People may not be able to move the same volume that they are moving in a week now. Whitney Robertson, an epidemiologist from the Gilling School of Public Health at UNC Chapel Hill, said in an email, "I think the next phases will be harder to vaccinate than the first phase of the population. I think we will need to switch strategies to meet the needs of the next group." Harrelson described how in his county it had been relatively easy to bring a group of providers to one place, line up recipients, and give out shots quickly. He said his vaccination clinics could process about 35 patients every quarter hour in clinics taking place 4 days a week. The second dose clinics went even faster. He said, number one, you've already registered. You're already in the system. And number two, you don't have to have people to schedule second appointments either. But the pace is slowing. There are people who can't make it to a daytime clinic, either because of work or family obligations, Harrelson said. There are homebound folks who lack the ability to travel to a centralized location, or people who lack transportation for whom the vaccine will have to come to them. And then there are those vaccine-hesitant folks. It'll take time and more effort to get the next layer of people vaccinated. Harrelson went on, just this past week, our hospital got 200 doses of Johnson & Johnson, and they were just doing pop-up clinics all around town. And it took them pretty much the better part of the week to get rid of those 200 doses. Harrelson said he's proud that Craven County has vaccinated more than 81% of the more than 20,000 people over the age of 65. All told, a county with 104,000 residents has had 30,000 people receive at least one dose. But at only about 30% of the total population to have gotten a shot, that's a long way from the level that health authorities estimate would be required for herd immunity. Governor Cooper said last week that his administration's goal is to get about two-thirds of North Carolinians vaccinated. He said, with at least two-thirds of adults vaccinated, our public health experts believe we will have enough protection across our communities to be able to live more safely with this virus. Anthony Fauci, head of National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, told CNN that herd immunity might be reached if 70 to 85% of people are immune, but two-thirds of people is a long way from where North Carolina is right now. Robinson said, I think we'll need to switch strategies to meet the needs of the next group and vaccinate them at a steady, strong pace. Harrelson said he's seen that some younger people are hanging back from getting vaccinations for various reasons. They may already have had COVID. Other young people tell him they're willing to take their chances. They're just saying, he said, hey, look, at this point, I know the transmission rates are lower than they've been in a long time. A lot of other people have been vaccinated. They also hear about people getting the second dose and maybe feeling sick for a day or maybe the weekend. I really do see, he says, that a lot of people are saying, well, you know, I've known people who actually got the virus that didn't hardly get sick at all. So I think I'm just going to take my chances. Kinsley said that the State Department is pivoting on its strategy now. There will still be mass vaccination clinics. For instance, the timeline for the huge FEMA-run clinic in Greensboro has been extended to the end of May. But now, instead of needing an appointment, people can just drive up and get a shot. That's becoming the case around the state with more walk-in opportunities springing up. Kinsley says, my hope is that you walk down the street, you pass three opportunities to get vaccinated. We're definitely moving into this phase where we have to be easy for folks. We have to be everywhere for folks. He admitted this next phase would likely be slower. Instead of health directors like Harrelson being able to vaccinate hundreds in a couple of hours, now the throughput will be maybe a dozen people per hour in a drugstore. Kinsley said it definitely gets more complex. Some providers may only be able to do 50 shots a week as opposed to 100 shots a week. Then there are the conspiracy theories. Lisa Harrison, health director for Granville Vance Health Department, said there's some heady stuff out there. Harrison said she's heard it all. Worries about safety, worries about the vaccine development process, worries about microchips, and lots of distrust of the government. She said it's all been debunked, but nobody's paying attention to the articles that talk about how false it is, right? It's interesting, she said, how many people continue to just be anti-government, anti-vaccine, and that's a group we'll never get there. Paul Delamater from the Geography Department at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, ruefully agreed with Harrison. He studies vaccine hesitancy, including people's attitudes about the annual flu vaccine. He noted that usually the U.S. gives flu vaccine to just under 50% of the people, quote, which I think is poorly considering almost every single person is eligible for a shot. Delamater has been tracking COVID cases, deaths, the spread, and now vaccination, and modeling how we would get to herd immunity. His estimate right now is that between people who got COVID, either with or without symptoms, and people who have been vaccinated, around 4 million North Carolinians are immune. That means there's another 3 million or more people to get vaccinated before any herd immunity threshold. Some of those might be kids who are not yet eligible for vaccination. There are about 2 million children in the state, but they likely won't all get vaccines either. Harrison said, once it's approved in children, you're going to see a whole different level of activity from the anti-vax movement. Then that's going to be lit on fire. Delamater agreed there are definitely some people who will never agree to get a COVID vaccine, and the effort shouldn't be focused on trying to convince them. He said, just put all your effort toward the people who are wait and see and build confidence in them. I feel like that group's probably bigger, and it's probably the group you're actually going to move some people, you know, and really have an effect. Kinsley said that to reach those wait and see folks, vaccines need to be everywhere, from doctor's offices to pharmacies to mobile clinics that can go out to where people are, and there may need to be inducements, too. He said with a laugh, I'd just like to say that a vaccine and a hush puppy sounds like a winning option to me. Next, the cover story for this Indie Week, The Rise of the Nugget by Sarah Edwards. One evening in the summer of 2018, writes Sarah Edwards, I ran into the entrepreneur David Barron, whom I vaguely knew from the undergraduate days at UNC Chapel Hill. Over the din of Durham's surf club bar, Barron explained he'd spent the last few years designing a modular children's couch. He handed over his phone with pictures that showed a construction of mod colorful cushions, like something you'd see in an airport lounge. Politely sipping my beer, I remember thinking, no way this is going to be a thing. I was wrong. The couch, which retails for $229, has attracted a devoted following and a hype that, ticking up over the years, nearly reached a fever pitch during the great indoor year that was 2020. Named Nugget, the couch has become a social phenomenon that bridges divides between play and home life, toy and furniture, spawning an entire market of knockoff designs in the process. But more than that, Barron, alongside co-founders Ryan Kocha and Hannah Fussell, seems to have built an equitable, conscientious company, one that may be the new face of North Carolina furniture manufacturing. On its own face, a nugget is simple. It consists of four foam pieces, two triangle pillows, one seat cushion, and one base, and currently comes in 18 colors. For families doing both school and life at home during the pandemic, the Nugget, which can be rearranged into slip sides, forts, or just a regular-looking couch, has become a ticket to a creative, customizable, and padded new world. Rave customer reviews emphasize the versatility of the design. Reviewer Amy Taylor wrote on the Nugget website, This product beyond exceeded my expectation, and my son is obsessed. And I personally want all things nuggety. Everyone seemed to want all things nuggety. Getting them has been another thing entirely. Even before the pandemic, the small company, which manufactures out of Butner, North Carolina, had been struggling to catch up on mounting orders. Since 2017, demand has roughly tripled each year. At the onset of the pandemic, the company was still fulfilling orders from the end of 2019. Lockdown set the company farther behind. In mid-March, cautious about the epidemic, Nugget paused its operations and Nugget staff, then around 20 people, went home with pay and benefits for 45 days. The closure drove fulfilled orders down and parental hype up. At one point, there were 200,000 people on the waitlist, and the resale market boomed, with Nuggets selling for 500, then 1,000, then several times that. Knockoffs also began to pop up in the market. In a profile of the company, BuzzFeed described the coveted couch as a supreme drop for moms. And by the fall, Inc. magazine had named Nugget the fastest-growing furniture manufacturer in the United States and fastest-growing company in North Carolina. Last October, looking to level the playing field and manage expectations, the company created a Nugget Lotto system. The first week, there were nearly 300,000 entries for the 10,000 Nugget slots. Now, the Nugget creation story goes back to UNC Chapel Hill, where the three founders met and where Nugget Comfort CEO Barron first dreamed up the idea for the company. At first, he sought to reimagine one of the creakiest, most disposable facets of college life, the dorm room futon. Barron says, "It hit me like a brick. What was a demonstrated desire that people kept on buying, but nobody liked? Asymmetric information kept cheap college futons in demand," Barron reasoned. Despite their long list of drawbacks, bulk, discomfort, and the fact they don't even convert particularly well from couch to bed. From there, Barron and Kocha, the founder of local streetwear company Thrill City, who had come on board, began to imagine a piece of furniture as elemental as a cushion. In 2015, the pair launched a Kickstarter for the easiest couch ever. It didn't take long for 574 backers to pledge $85,000 to bring Nugget to life. Over Zoom, Barron, who has a deep baritone voice and an engaged, almost electric conversational style, explained that in those early Nugget days, he was already trying to imagine what kind of company he wanted to build. Quote, "The core tenet of a good company is that you don't hurt anyone in the process of what you're doing. You are ultra aware and you don't hurt anyone, internally, externally, or indirectly." In 2017, the pair sent a design to Kocha's partner, Hannah Fussell, a fourth grade public school teacher. It proved a fortuitous shipment. Fussell's classroom loved the Nugget, and when she returned to North Carolina later that year, she joined the company as an intern. Immediately, she made key changes, phasing out the stark white zippers and bright Crayola colors and replacing them with an appealing palette of shades ranging from cactus and blue jean to redwood and bamboo. If parents were going to integrate Nuggets into their common spaces, she reasoned, they were going to want to look at them all day. Knowing how vital convenience is to caregivers, she also made the machine washable covers easier to remove. Soon, Fussell fell in love with the work and the possibilities for carrying on the state's legacy of textile manufacturing. She says, "Now, I'm the head of product for a furniture company in the great state of North Carolina, the furniture capital of the world. We're always thinking, how can we continue to be talking about bringing furniture back to North Carolina?" During her first few years, Fussell always expanded brand reach by making connections with Triangle area parents. Maddie Galden, a mother of two in Durham, was one of the original Triangle parents whom Fussell contacted. She is drawn to toys with the potential for open-ended play to encourage their imagination, she says. And despite a 3.5-year age gap between her sons, the Nugget has been functional common ground for both of them. She spread the word, it's essential when playing The Floor is Lava. These grassroots efforts were the beginning of a marketing journey that hasn't relied all that much on marketing. Notably, the company has never paid for advertising, instead relying on an inviting social media strategy and word of mouth. This includes Facebook. When I began researching the company, knowing that Facebook was a major contributor to the Nugget zeitgeist, I did a perfunctory search, expecting to encounter one or two Facebook groups. Instead, I lost count after 40. There are regional Nugget chapters and military parent Nugget groups, and even the Nugget Comfort Club, BST, and more chapter, which bears the peculiar disclaimer, no drama. The largest group has 69,000 members. Posts run the gamut from photos of creative fort builds or hype about a forthcoming new color to questions of a more philosophical nature. Quote, if you had all the money in the world, how many Nuggets would you own? Scroll a bit further down the Nugget Facebook fandom and you'll come across several well-populated groups themed around Nuggets After Dark. And yes, reader, those groups feature exactly the kind of adult conversations you might expect. But perhaps a few PG-13 subcultures are just a byproduct of making a really, really popular couch. Kocha says the company approach toward the Facebook group phenomenon is hands-off, and the desire to unite and build a community around a product, he reasons, is only natural. That's for the best, as the company has had plenty of other things to focus on this year, like getting people their Nuggets. It's an area in which the company has experienced growing pains. By the end of 2020, they had shipped out an impressive 156,000 couches, though the lottery system means fundamentally that not everyone who wanted to have a Nugget under last year's Christmas tree got one. But Barron says he's not in a rush to overextend the capacity of a small company. He says we could always make more than we make if we were willing to bend our values. We never want to overwork anyone. A comfortably made Nugget is one of quality, and everyone deserves to have a high-quality, comfortable, well-paid job. We're never going to just ask for them to be made faster for the sake of being made faster. To that end, the company pays a living wage and offers health care to its employees, who now number 80, and have made local nonprofits like No Kid Hungry, Student U, and You Can Vote NC a fundraising focus. Coca adds, as a family company, I think it's an obvious connection that you would try to run things in a way that's more thoughtful about the future. It's not like we have it all figured out, but last year was a great opportunity for us to show some leadership. The social efforts make a strong case that Nugget is more than just a bunch of cushions, that it is a company nurturing local roots and, in the process, shifting a nationwide conversation about what home, play, and family life means. The toy market is famously faddish. Tickle Me Elmo topping the charts one year, Furby the next, but Nuggets corner two markets at once. They don't go in the toy bin at the end of the day because they're a part of the room and the home. Barron also doesn't rule out creating new kinds of Nugget comfort products in the future either, when the team is ready, and he says, the pandemic is a catalyst for people understanding that the home is an important place for family time, comfort, education, and creativity, that the home is a lot more than a respite for everything happening outside of it. Galden, the mother who was an early Nugget adopter, echoes this sentiment. She told Indy, I'm not surprised at all they're this successful. What sets them apart is not just that it's a well-made product, but that they have built such a solid team and have great leadership at the helm. As a parent today, I really try to be an ethical consumer whenever possible. And I don't think I'm alone in that. Well, my last couple weeks' readings have had to shortchange some arts articles, and I think I will move over to a couple of music and stage articles right now, get those in, and continue with what time we have left. Bring It Home by Eric Tullis talks about Coolie High, release Lazy Sunday. One of hip-hop's prevailing mid-pandemic trends has been for acts to package small servings of their music as a placeholder as the music industry and economy reactivate. But this just might be the only trend that the locally pioneering five-man hip-hop crew, Coolie High, has followed over a 15-year career, largely dignified by a casual disregard for whatever music or movements are a la mode at the time. Led once again by MCs Charlie Smarts and Tab One, Coolie High's new three-pack EP titled Lazy Sunday is no different. While this brief offering sounds at home stylistically for Coolie High, it seems as though the aspiration here is to get us to remember when being at home was more of a reference point than a decree. This could explain why three of the four producers on Lazy Sunday were from outside of the Coolie camp. On the opener, Hold Up, Ukrainian producer KLIM raises his boom-bap influences to the occasion, gifting Coolie's parlayers with a rich rush of twinkling chimes under concise snares and bass lines. Tab One hops spryly from one bar to the next with rhymes of encouragement. Next, on Rollin' in the Hay, they invite producer Eric G. and the ever-ready rhymer GQ, both of whom are Jamla Records label mates, with former Coolie High MC Rhapsody to the affair. Some of the more melodic musings that Charlie Smarts has been toying with over the last several years come to light here over Eric G.'s pictorial-as-usual beat profile, ultimately setting the tone for guest GQ to put on a show-stealing masterclass in wordplay. If there's one thing that sticks out on this track listing more than it actually sticks, it's the guest remix production by Static Selecta for the title track, which also features Brooklyn vocalist Melanie Charles. Besides Charles' refreshing vocals, it's neither much of an ambitious veer from the original Synopsis-produced song, nor does it highlight the dustiness and grit that Static Selecta's reputation as a crate-digging DJ and beatmaker is built on. It's quite possibly his most relaxed work behind the boards, but that's what Lazy Sundays and Coolie High have always been about. The luxury to be both unbothered and unmatched. And this music review by Eric Tullis, Coolie High's Lazy Sunday, gets 3 stars. It was released April 23rd on MECCA, Mecca Records. On to the stage, Byron Woods talks about content creators and the Durham Savoyards. The pandemic forced the Savoyards to reimagine a 19th century satirical opera in the internet age. All it took was a little patience. In the opening moments of a new YouTube miniseries, a group of cold-eyed, mooning fangirls pop one by one into the panels of an online video conference. After genuflecting to bedroom posters of their idol, a poet whose brooding visage evokes a glam-era Rasputin, they burst simultaneously into an unlikely song, 20 Lovesick Maidens We, a tune from the dawn of the 1880s. That number opens W.S. Gilbert and Arthur Sullivan's comic opera, Patience, and the anachronous social media sequence kicks off director Melissa S. Crabbe Dombrowski's online modern-day adaptation of the Victorian-era satire for the Durham Savoyards, the region's long-standing light opera company that was founded in 1963. The creative team, which includes music director Joanna Sisk-Purvis and video editor John Paul Middlesworth, has split the evening-length work into 7 weekly episodes, 4 of which have rolled out since the March 26 season opener. The remaining 3 will debut each Friday through the finale on May 7. Previous segments remain viewable on the company's YouTube channel. But why reframe a 140-year-old satire on pretentious artistic fads into an online beef between passionate devotees and detractors of an overly precious, simpering huckster of a poet? Dombrowski says Gilbert and Sullivan made great fun of their culture's foibles, and they have not changed so much since then. Patience, she notes, ultimately looks at the frivolousness of artistic fashions and how we still tie ourselves up in knots about them. The message is still relevant and very funny. But Dombrowski quickly offers another reason for the 21st century facelift. It isn't as if the Savoyards had that much choice. The first attempt at the present production fell apart in March of last year when Durham's Carolina Theater went dark due to COVID less than 2 weeks before opening night. Dombrowski says the actors and the people who were building sets, they basically had it all nailed down, then they had to dismantle it, which was heartbreaking. A rescheduled run last August fell through due to the pandemic. About to pass the 2-year mark since their last show, a spring 2019 run of The Mikado, the Savoyards realized they needed a contingency plan that didn't rely on reopened theaters. Dombrowski recalls, since the only venue available to us was the internet, we chose to lean into that and make a sense of place there. For her, modernizing Patience was the only viable decision for its online media to make sense. A deliberate artistic choice, she notes, rather than something we were stuck with. And in doing so, Dombrowski calculated that the sudden shifts in our culture would actually back her move. She notes, we've all had a year where we've been separated by screens, where the only way to be connected was to be online, with so many of our live interactions happening through social media. It got to the point that being online for us was being live, that experience became present. Presence and immediate for us, since that was all we had. These days, she concludes, online is as live as many of us still get. Putting Gilbert and Sullivan online wasn't easy. For safety, none of the actors or musicians gathered for rehearsal or production. Rehearsals and scenes were done remotely. An online production of Gilbert's one-act comedy, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, mounted as a trial run last September, revealed that actors on Zoom had to start each line a split second sooner than they ordinarily would. Dombrowski said, otherwise it started getting really slow and Gilbert and Sullivan had to be snappy. After Sisk-Purvis circulated video guide tracks for each number with pianist Cole Swanson, vocalists, chorus members, and instrumentalists in the orchestra recorded and submitted their parts separately. Sisk-Purvis then assembled the audio files in Logic Pro and mixed the final soundtrack. Middlesworth did the same with video footage and the dialogue of the singers. Sisk-Purvis admits, it took so much time, but it's worked. With 2 fully mounted productions and no revenue from ticket sales, the Savoyards is counting on public donations to cover its cost. Dombrowski says, we need our community's support. Throughout production planning, the company chose to make the show more accessible to larger audiences. They resolved not to place it behind a monetizing paywall. Then, they decided to divide it into user-friendly episodes. Dombrowski's, the general feeling is that most people watch about 15 to 20 minutes on YouTube before they're done. In the process, a work that once could be accessed only through pricey tickets with an entire evening invested becomes available to anyone with an internet connection and 20 to 30 minutes of spare time. Sisk Purvis says it has the potential to reach a much wider audience than we normally do. An early significant signal that that's working came when Sisk Purvis showed an episode to a group of middle schoolers. She says, they thought it was hilarious. The online chats and memes helped make it really clear what was going on. They might not have gotten some of the older references, but who does these days? That was really exciting. Now I will have to shortchange Jordan Lawrence's column of music reviews from Bowerbirds, which is now a single artist rather than a duo, and there's a discussion about his new release called Be Calm, Young Lovers. And the next article I will have time for is a story about online thrift stores called Secondhand Dreams by Emma Kenfield. I believe I have time for this. For 20 years, Allison Matney sat hunched in front of a desktop computer, 20 years confined to a cubicle. Matney has a colorful persona. Tattoos crawl up both arms and hair is shaved on both sides of her head, and found corporate America draining. It meant financial stability, but mental debility. With her 40th birthday approaching in March 2020, she decided to call it quits, intent on following her passion for design. Meanwhile, Hannah Spector had just re-entered the restaurant industry after a decade of working with Planned Parenthood, drained and tired of taking her job home with her. Each day she quit and took up bartending while figuring out next steps. Then the pandemic happened. Spector lost her restaurant job. Matney was panicking, too, as she just quit her job weeks prior and opportunities were proving scarce. Matney says, during the summer, I thought, oh, my gosh, what have I done? I don't have a paycheck. I'm not on unemployment. I don't have any savings anymore. But something inside me was just like, it's going to work out. Well, today, Matney is the proud owner of Bull City Vintage, a vintage reseller based in Durham that now has more than 5,000 followers on Instagram. In April 24th, Matney opened her first showroom at 420 West Lakewood Avenue, featuring her collection of mid-century furniture, polished decor, and knickknacks. The showroom for now does not have regular hours like a retail space, but Matney plans to hold monthly pop-up events featuring other Triangle sellers. The showroom will also be open by appointment. The Bull City Vintage showroom opening was held at the space last Saturday, extending into Sunday due to rain. Around 200 people showed up, sifting through Matney's treasures indoors and stopping by other resellers' pop-up stands outside. One of these resellers was Hannah Spector. Spector created Spector Vintage Plus Design shortly after the pandemic hit as well, with more than 2,000 followers on Instagram today. She sells vintage decor and furniture of all kinds, antique ceramics, and one-of-a-kind textile artwork. She says, when the pandemic hit, it was a great kick in the ass because I had to figure out a way to make money. I definitely physically take my work home with me now, but it's a different kind of taking work home with you. I really love what I'm doing. For many people, the pandemic, despite the anxiety, loss, and fear, forced them to hit a reset button and follow passions they'd previously set aside. For some, like Matney and Spector, it opened them up to vintage reselling, invigorating their love for new beginnings, home decor, and sustainability. Growing up in New York City, Hannah Spector was a self-declared punk. In middle school, hooked by the message of punk music, she began to attend shows, favoring the activist nights at former New York City venue Wetlands Preserve. This introduced an interest in sustainability and social reform. She says, there's such an abundance of items out there. Instead of buying new things, which may not be made ethically and certainly requires processes that pollute the environment, you're minimizing your impact and your carbon footprint. When faced with unemployment during the pandemic years later, Spector created her vintage reselling account, Spectre Vintage and Design, which reached its one-year anniversary in March and has allowed her to work when she wants and feel fulfilled, knowing her job aligns with her belief. Matney's Instagram shop, meanwhile, opened a bit later than Spectre's. In October last year, she purchased a mid-century modern dresser from an estate sale. It has been a long summer. A single mom, she spent most of her time home with her son, where room by room she'd been renovating her house. Hunting for new additions to her home on a budget, she frequented estate sales. On this day, the dresser spoke to her. Matney says, "I didn't want to turn around and resell it for $800, because people shouldn't be paying that much money for mid-century modern stuff. I want people, just like me, to be able to afford really cool pieces." On Etsy and eBay, genuine mid-century modern pieces, especially dressers, typically range from $500 to thousands of dollars. Replicas sold by Overstock and Wayfair are cheaper, within the range of $200 to $500, but they lack the authenticity and durability of genuine pieces. Matney believes vintage items are for everyone. She says too many resellers turn the affordable to the unattainable, and in a city already battling gentrification, she wants to assure that community that nice, quality furniture is not a luxury reserved only for the moneyed. She cleaned the dresser, touched it up, and sold it for $175. The epiphany shot her into a newfound passion for vintage reselling. She continued reselling and created an Instagram account called @BullCityVintageNC. The name came to her, a Durham native, effortlessly. "I've seen the city change over the last 40 years, Matney says. "It's my home, and I want to keep that as part of the shop." Well, I have to bring this article to a close, I'm sorry. And I also have to skip completely a very interesting-looking article called Airstream Adventures, How to Deck Out a 1970s Camper Trailer and Move Across the Country by Laura Guidry. And those who are particularly interested, of course, can look up Indie Week online and read these articles and the conclusion of the ones that I've missed. Well, John Federson has to hang it up today for this issue, which will appear on ncreadingservice.org for the next week. And we hope to see all of you again, or for you to hear us, on Indie Week. So long, folks.